Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, February 12th, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Highway 101 billboard to come down following closed supervisors vote, Humboldt Literacy Project students and tutors write anthology book Tapestry, and Cal Poly Humboldt professor researches 300-million-year-old shark fossils in the Fayetteville Shale. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkyon, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
One by one, billboards along the coastal corridor of Highway 101 in Humboldt County are coming down, and the latest is in the Elk River area. Daniel Mintz reports.
A trend of billboard removal continues as a majority of Humboldt County supervisors has taken action to remove one in the Elk River area of Highway 101. A five-year permit period for the doomed billboard ended in late September, and the Board of Supervisors denied an extension request at its February 10th meeting. Toppled during a winter storm in 2019, the billboard was re-erected in late 2020 under a special permit approved by supervisors. Reflecting visual and environmental concerns over billboards in the 101 coastal area, the county's planning commission had denied a reconstruction permit and the decision was appealed to supervisors. The supervisor's 2020 approval of the special permit was conditioned on the billboard's removal after 5 years. The end of that period brought the extension applicants, Jeff Wills and Outfront Media, before supervisors again with arguments largely focusing on economic impacts. Wills believes the billboard can't be removed without compensation, and he juxtaposed animus towards billboards against contribution to the local economy and his income.
A lot of people really despise billboards. Well, that's the subjective opinion of someone's personal feelings. I'm here to tell you objectively that this is my livelihood. This is my investment. I stood at this very podium in 2014 before I invested $2 million in my billboard company and asked the Board of Supervisors if a billboard that I own that was in a non-conforming stature, exactly like this, I literally even used an example of a billboard that was about 100 yards away, could it ever be compelled to be removed without just compensation? And Rob Wall, the director, and the Board of Supervisors in 2014 told me it could not. I could not have one of my properties that I invested in taken away from me without being compensated for it. So you guys have the choice to essentially appease people's subjective feelings on whether they want to see a billboard or not, or the fact that this billboard contributes to our local economy and is a substantial part of my business, my wealth, my retirement, everything.
Representing Wills, attorney Jeff Slack said removal of the billboard would, quote, destroy Wills' investment, and, quote, these issues weren't considered at the time that this five-year limit was imposed. The argument based on vested rights and compensation was addressed by senior planner Steve Lazar. He said the billboard was considered a non-conforming structure prior to 2020, which means it didn't conform to the county's rules, but its existence predated them, so it had a right to stand. That changed after it fell, as the state's Outdoor Advertising Act treats billboard reconstruction as a new build subject to recently adopted county rules, which was repeatedly explained by Planning Director John Ford.
So the 2014 question was, we've got non-conforming signs out there. Is the county going to come and require removal of those? And the question is, and this come, or the answer is, and this come, the policy is, and this comes out of the Outdoor Advertising Act, that if the county were going to do that, there would be an amortization period and a reimbursement period. But this is not that. This is a new conforming sign that was approved to allow reconstruction of the sign with a five-year period. And so the non-conforming argument is gone. That doesn't exist anymore. It's not a non-conforming sign. I heard that several times, and I feel a need to be a little redundant on making that point.
Although Lazar said more than 50 anti-billboard public comments were received in the days leading to the hearing, there were few who spoke during it. A representative of Humboldt Waterkeeper supported denial of the extension, and Arcata resident David Meserve said the denial is a no-brainer, as Wills had agreed to the 5-year permit term. Wills contested that, but Lazar had said, quote, "The applicant was party to all of the actions that were taken by the Planning Commission and the board, and they were there for the hearing where the special permit was approved." Board Chair Mike Wilson highlighted the billboard's location in an environmentally sensitive area.
And I also want to emphasize for the record that we did have, and also within the findings, issues around impacts to fill in wetlands, issues around impacts to view sheds. There are impacts that we're talking about, and this is a new structure.
The vote to deny the extension was close at 3-2, with Supervisors Rex Bone and Michelle Bushnell in the minority. Ford said if the billboard remains standing, it will become, quote, an enforcement action, either for the county or for the state. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Yesterday, the Humboldt Literacy Project, HLP, announced their book Tapestry. The book is an anthology of different works from their tutors and learners building their English language skills. HLP was founded in 1981 and provides free and confidential one-on-one English language tutoring for functionally illiterate adults in the Humboldt County area. KMUD News spoke with Emma Brican, Executive Director at HLP, for more information about what they do.
We have been here since 1981, and we help adults with their reading and writing. So if you're over 18 and you need to build your skills to get a better job, help your kids with the homework, whatever you're trying to do, we will match you one-on-one with a volunteer tutor to help you work towards your goals on your own schedule.
This is the first time the nonprofit organization has done a project like this, and their book Tapestry intends to highlight the progress made by their learners in their English language skills. The anthology consists of poetry, essays, fiction, recipes, and much more, all created by their tutors and students over the course of a year.
Last year, we decided to go ahead and attempt to put together an anthology of works by our tutors and learners. So they spent several months working on their pieces, their contributions, and we put them in a book. So we've got this book called Tapestry, because as you know, a tapestry is a weaving of different threads all coming together in a thing of beauty. And so we've got this book, and we're incredibly proud of our learners and tutors. There's not a theme. It is truly a tapestry, a stew, a hodgepodge. There's just a little bit of everything in there. Some paintings, there's some recipes, there's some personal essays, there's some short fiction.
Planning, gathering, and creating works and formatting took approximately a year for the project, and prior to announcement, the organization made sure that everyone that contributed received their own copy.
Honestly, the push came from our own outreach coordinator, Jessica Ricker. She's the one who actually got the ball rolling and said, let's do this, and then figured out how on earth are we going to get this thing formatted and how are we going to get it printed. It was several months of simply talking to the tutors and learners and, you know, having them work on their projects and get them into us. And then probably several weeks of back and forth with the proofreader and the formatter and a few more weeks with the publisher. So we probably got it in hand around last October, and we debuted it at our appreciation night, which is a private event for our tutors and learners, so that we could get it into the hands of the people who contributed to it, because it's, of course, it's a very special edition limited run. So now that everyone who actually took part in it has their copy, we're making it available to the public. Anyone from the public who is interested in this completely unique piece of work, you can't even buy it. It is free with a donation of $25 or more while supplies last.
For more information about the Humboldt Literacy Project, the website is humboldtliteracy.org. Allison Bronson, an assistant professor at Cal Poly Humboldt, talks to KMUD about complete skeletons of sharks over 300 million years old found in northwestern Arkansas that are leading to new evolutionary discoveries. Gabriel Zucker reports.
A new study was published with the help of a Cal Poly Humboldt professor. The research paper is about a series of geological sites known as the Fayetteville Shale, located in northwestern Arkansas, where three-dimensional shark skeletons dating back to more than 300 million years can be found. The fossils were preserved because of a low oxygen, high acidic seafloor that preserved the cartilage of these creatures for hundreds of millions of years. Allison Bronson, an assistant professor at Cal Poly Humboldt, is leading author of the study and talked with KMUD about the findings from the site.
We've been visiting these sites in what's now Arkansas for many years. These were sites that were initially studied long ago because they're oil-bearing shales, and then were explored for plant fossils and invertebrate fossils, and the vertebrates, the fishes, were only really recently addressed. So what we've been doing is mostly working from recently collected material and also from material housed at the American Museum of Natural History to study fossil cartilage that's preserved really well at these sites. And that fossil cartilage is very rare. Most of the shark fossil record is teeth. So having the opportunity to study cartilage gives us a lot more information about the anatomy of extinct groups of fishes. And then we can use that anatomy to understand how these different groups evolved. So understanding those groups depends on having fossil cartilage, but most sites don't preserve fossil cartilage well. When we studied the environment that would have been there 300 million years ago in Arkansas, we were able to figure out a little bit more about why cartilage was so well preserved in these sites. A lot of the sites are either at road cuts. Geologists love a road cut. So a lot of the sites are exposed on the side of a road or by a riverbed. And so in particular, when we're collecting on these riverbeds, you can see the layers of rock exposed there in the walls of these little river canyons. And we look carefully for sort of characteristic textures that are weathering out of the rock. And some of it is as easy as picking things up as they're weathering out from the walls of the river. And then sometimes we have to sort of dig things out with rock hammers or with a little pick or a crowbar.
Bronson went into detail about how it is possible these skeletons were preserved for so long in this area.
The seafloor at the time, these are about 326 million years old. It looks like the marine environment there had periodic rapid burial events. So fossils were covered over with sediment relatively quickly. And the work we've recently done shows this sort of concentric formation of mineralization around the fossil. So in the center of these little concretions of rock, there's cartilage material. And then around it, very quickly, mineralization was happening in an environment that both had very little oxygen and was also called a reducing environment, but basically was acidic. And so decay was being inhibited so that the cartilage was well preserved.
The skeletons that Bronson is studying show the relationship between different groups of fish. They also show different traits that evolved over the last 300 million years.
Cartilaginous fishes, sharks and their relatives, are really, really old. They're more than 450 million years old as a group. And understanding how different groups of fishes are related to each other then gives us an idea of how different traits evolved and what things, you know, were successful over evolutionary time, or what traits do we see in certain habitats. So we have to understand how groups of fishes are related to each other to make sense of these evolutionary innovations. And the incredible preservation from the Fayetteville Shale has given us fossils that have complete gill structures, so we can understand that sharks have bony ancestors, that they came from bony fishes, not the other way around. There are fossils there that have sort of transitional looking features between sharks and ratfish, and we can use those to understand evolutionary relationships. And there are others that have some parts of their anatomy that are very primitive looking, like a very primitive shark skull, but with teeth that are specialized for tearing, which is something that you see more in more recent species. So the complexity and detail of the preservation of their skeletons has given us a huge array of fossils that preserve anatomy that's really key for understanding these evolutionary novelties and innovations.
The preservation of these ancient fossils is very rare, and the level of preservation shows a litany of findings related to the novelties of evolution.
I worked on a species called Carcharopsis worthenii, and it was described back in the 70s from these sites. But most of these fish fossils have actually been collected over the years by really eagle-eyed invertebrate and plant paleontologists that have a great eye for fossil cartilage and teeth. And so they had the foresight and the generosity to collect this material, curate it, and donate it to the American Museum of Natural History, where I was a grad student. And so they donated over, I think it was over 300,000 fossils to the collection there. And so all of these were aggregated because people were interested in the invertebrates and the plants and the geology. And so years and years later, our research group started investigating the fishes because we had all of this material already there.
While this area was only recently studied for fish fossils, paleontologists have been collecting these fossils throughout the years, just in case it became important later on, a fact Bronson is very thankful for.
Paleontology is largely enabled if you can get in the field and if you can travel to collections, then you're able to do your research. We are able to do a lot of this because Cal Poly Humboldt has a CT scanner that we got in 2020 with NSF funding. And that CT scanner here at Humboldt, as well as one in New York at the Natural History Museum there, are where we study the anatomy of these fossils. But it was a very collaborative effort. So I'm a research associate with the museum in New York, with the American Museum of Natural History, as well as a professor here. And so I worked with friends from the museum and then friends of their friends as well. So we got to use equipment called the synchrotron scanner in France, which was able to assess the mineral composition of the rocks that contain the fossils.
Bronson said this research was done through collaboration and the sharing of data all around the world.
There are still many fossils from these sites that were in the process of describing and understanding their anatomy. So I'm working with friends from this paper and others to go through all of the holdings in the museum from these sites and use mostly CT scanning to reconstruct their anatomy. And at the same time, we also use the anatomy that's already been described for studies of shark evolutionary history. So we basically put together like a family tree, so to speak, of shark relationships over geological time. And then we're also hoping in the next year or two to make a return to Shark and Saw for more collecting, because it's been a few years since we've been out there and everyone wants to go back.
Even though Bronson has not been to the area in years, does not mean she isn't still studying these findings and learning new things.
We benefit so much from the collections of curators and researchers that were there for many, many, many years before us. So I'm very lucky to go back there relatively often and get to work in the collection. And so even just from the Fayetteville material, I'll be looking through drawers of little concretions and say like, oh, this is a little tiny, you know, a fin spine that I didn't know was in here, or a tiny little tooth that we didn't know was in here. And so last time I was there, for example, I got to spend more time looking at this tiny little fish jaw that was in one of these concretions. And a friend let me use their cool microscope in their lab, and we noticed structures of the teeth that we hadn't seen before. We also have been working on, we did a CT scan while I was there that showed us a 3D fin from one of these sharks that we hadn't noticed before. So there's a lot, because museums are these amazing repositories of diversity and have so many specimens for study, every time you have the time to go look through them, you can find new projects to work on.
The study is called Vertebrae Assemblage and Depositional Environment of the Fayetteville Shale, and can be found at sciencedirect.com. This is Gabriel Zucker with KMUD News.
In state news, California bill would bar ICE from public jobs like police or teacher, KPFA's Lauren Schmidt reports.
Assemblymember Mark Gonzalez announced the legislation, titled GTFO.
In other words, get the feds out.
Gonzalez made the announcement in Los Angeles, where he said a growing and dangerous pattern of federal power has been directed at Democratic cities.
ICE publicly executed Renee Good. ICE forcibly took a five-year-old from their family. ICE murdered a peaceful protester in broad daylight. ICE has no shame. ICE does not care. ICE enforces fear, breaks families, and betrays the humanity that it claims to protect.
Gonzalez spoke from the steps of the Japanese American National Museum, where its president, Anne Burroughs, outlined its significance.
It was here in 1942, following the signing of Executive Order 9066, that thousands of Japanese Americans in Los Angeles were ordered to report, stripped of their rights and property, and forcibly removed to America's concentration camps. More than 125,000 people of Japanese ancestry were incarcerated illegally by the U.S. government during World War II. And this museum was founded here on this place in order to remember truth, to commemorate truth and memory, to ensure that what happened here in 1942 would never happen again.
A promise she fears is not being kept.
Just 5 months ago, this very plaza, which is hallowed ground for Japanese Americans, was invaded by dozens of armed and masked federal agents. A man was seized and incarcerated right here on a site meant to warn exactly against this kind of state violence.
Los Angeles State Senator Maria Elena Durazo described ICE agents as forcibly abducting people off the streets without notice, without due process, and with little regard for human rights or the law, calling it deeply concerning that a branch of the U.S. government tasked with upholding the law is instead breaking it.
Fascism is growing right before our very eyes. Since January 20th, immigration enforcement has transformed into something unrecognizable. Militarized authoritarian force that operates without warrants, without accountability, without any sense of humanity. Border patrol agents are counting bullet holes instead of getting people like Alex Pretty medical help. Masked agents are shooting to kill. They're entering homes without warrants. A climate of pure fear is their goal. The whole system is broken.
Durazo said extraordinary times call for extraordinary measures.
And we would never have proposed legislation like this because there were rules. And those rules don't exist anymore under this Trump administration.
If passed, the bill would establish new hiring standards for teachers, judges, social workers, police officers, and other public employees. Those standards would take into account whether an applicant's employment history included work with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The legislation will be jointly introduced with Speaker Robert Rivas and could make its way to the Assembly floor for a vote as early as June 2026. For KPFA News, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
In National Native News, Brian Bull reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. It's been a month since hundreds of members of a Northern Ontario First Nation were put in hotels across the province after a water crisis. Many, however, have chosen to stay at the reserve. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, a state of emergency was declared in early January after a parasite was found in water samples and led to dozens of cases of gastrointestinal illnesses.
Medical staff left Kashishawan a week ago after consultation with community leaders, but they say residents who remain will still be able to access healthcare services. Lisa Westaway is the Regional Executive for Indigenous Services Canada.
We worked with WAHA, the Winnebago Area Health Authority, Orange, which is emergency land-based emergency response, and Ministry of Health to ensure that services are in place for community members who choose to remain in Kashishawan.
Band leaders in Kashishawan declared a state of emergency on January 4th after damage to the water system that led to sewage seeping into people's homes, creating a public health and safety issue. More than 1,500 people were sent to communities across Ontario, including Niagara Falls, Timmins, and Kingston. Less than 400 decided to stay. Tyson Wesley is the executive director of the Kashishawan First Nation.
A lot of people currently in the community are deciding to stay. However, we're trying to develop some plans to allow them to be there, such as our community across the river, Fort Albany. So we're trying to see how they can access healthcare.
More than 60 band members at the fly-in community on the western shore of James Bay have been diagnosed with the parasite Cryptosporidium, which causes gastrointestinal symptoms such as cramps, diarrhea, nausea, fever, and vomiting. Most cases are resolved without medication over a couple of weeks. It's still unclear when people will be able to return home. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Tribal leaders from across the country spoke out this week at a U.S. Senate hearing against possible changes within the Small Business Administration program that supports Native entities. Alaska Desk's Alona Niden reports.
The 8A Business Development Program provides federal contracting opportunities to socially disadvantaged individuals or tribes. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski co-led the oversight hearing focused on the program.
It delivers mission-critical work for civilian and defense agencies, and it promotes economic development in Native communities while helping to fulfill the federal trust responsibility.
But over the past year, the Federal Small Business Administration and other agencies have launched audits into the program and announced a sweeping suspension of companies participating in it. U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth also announced on social media last month that his department would be
taking a sledgehammer to the oldest DEI program in the federal government.
Murkowski says that Native-owned businesses participate in the program because Congress recognized the government's trust and treaty obligations to Native communities.
And that was not based on race. It was not based on DEI.
Catherine Carlton is Inupiat from Cordova and is the president of Chugach Alaska Corporation. Her organization has participated in the program for decades and has benefited from its economic opportunities.
For us, it provided the pathway to recover from the devastating Exxon Valdez oil spill in our region.
Polly Watson is vice president of operations at Bristol Bay Native Corporation and says her organization has several businesses participating in the 8A program. Watson says the corporation reinvests the revenue it receives through government contracts back into community. One example is a partnership with the State Division of Motor Vehicles to deliver mobile DMV services.
To bring real ID and driver's license services to 7 villages in the Bristol Bay region serving 544 rural residents.
Tribal leaders and senators from Nevada, Oklahoma, Montana, and Hawaii all spoke in support of the Native participation in the 8A program. In Anchorage, I am Alona Niden.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Dennis Marr, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Gabriel Zucker, Lauren Schmidt, and Brian Bull. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Matt Cardos.